Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Glazers, marketers of fine wines and spirits, and from the best chocolate in town, purveyors of fine chocolate and desserts located on Mass Ave. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2, The Point, and WFYI.org. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. We have got a lot going on this week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, starting with a new market that's opening next week in Fountain Square. Wildwood Market proprietor Craig Sanders fills us in on the new market that's opening in a former gas station and garage at 1015 Virginia Avenue. We also head to Pendleton to stop by Chef Jennifer Cheesem's new shop, Pierogi in a Pinch, and hear about that new business. And we're back in the kitchen with Alan Sternberg, executive chef at Cerulean in Indianapolis, as he takes on our Cook This Challenge. We'll also talk with Alan about the tasting menu that Cerulean offers. We'll also hear from beekeeper Kent Allison, who runs Two Bears Honey with partner Scott Tyler. We'll hear about their beekeeping business and what happens when a bee swarm finds you. And former beekeeper Tia Agnew, who went from keeping bees to selling honey to making honey wine to creating incredibly popular meads and ciders at New Day Craft, tells us about the upcoming release of the seasonal Breakfast Magpie Mead. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI.org. Well, I have to say that I love it when people in Indianapolis see a need for something and then figure out a way to make it happen. That's what Fountain Square resident Craig Sanders has done with his new Wildwood Market that's opening next week at 1015 Virginia Avenue. I stopped in the other day to check out the new market, located in a former garage, and to get a glimpse of what Craig has planned.
Yeah, after, you know, some long and hard work getting the building set up, we're all ready. We have done all of our renovations, all the equipment's in. We're ready to start bringing in product. So, we're just excited. I think the community's excited and the city's excited, so it should be a good experience.
Now tell me what you'll be carrying at the market.
We're going to have everything from fresh produce, so all at least primarily sourced fresh produce, all local. We'll be doing, beyond that, some luxury produce, so anything that's in season that's outside of the region. So right now, oranges from Florida, things like that will kind of feature, but we're going to try and stay as local and seasonal as possible. Then we'll have local meats, eggs, dairy, and then some artisan cheeses, charcuterie, and then a wide selection of dry goods and specialty items as well.
Now, how do you envision people using the market? You see it primarily for the neighborhood, or is it kind of a specialty shop? How do you see it?
Sure. I think we started out with the idea as a neighborhood market. My wife and I live here in Fountain Square, and saw the need and had a desire for a store like this ourselves, and that's kind of how we got started with the whole process. That's our primary vision for it. Beyond that, I think, we want to have stuff that people can't find anywhere else, so that maybe it is worth the drive out of the way to come visit us and try some new things, experience some new products, and be introduced and learn about other things that are happening in the city with some other producers.
Now tell me some of the specific products that you might be carrying. You mentioned charcuterie and some packaged meats and dry goods and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I mean, we're going to carry the traditional local products that you kind of see out: Trader's Point Creamery, Smoking Goose, Caprini Creamery, and then Capriole. Beyond that, a lot of things like Big Fork sausage from Chicago is a good one. American Spoon products from Michigan. So, getting outside of our, regionally, kind of our philosophy is the more fresh it is, the more local we want it to be. So, the produce, we want it to be as local as possible. But then as you get into some of the dry goods, we will be getting in some cheeses from, from Europe on occasion, and then pastas and things like that that are a little bit more dry. So,
Well, now you mentioned maybe bottled things, olive oils, vinegars, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, we'll have olive oils, vinegars, you know, hot sauces, you know, pasta sauce, things like that. You know, kind of anything that you need to complete a meal, to start a meal, you know, stuff to go with cheeses, mustards, jams, jellies, you know, kind of those types of things as well. Yeah.
Now, are you going – so are you going to be doing like deli meats and prepared sandwiches and that kind of thing?
So we will have some deli meats. Primarily for the sandwiches, we're going to be doing cured meats. So we will beginning in January. We're probably not going to start with it initially, but beginning in January, we'll start with a sandwich or two a day, all using some of the cured meats that we have in our charcuterie case, as well as a cheese and some, you know, seasonal vegetables, some kind of you know, dressing on it or olive oil at least, so people can come in and get a sandwich. We'll have, you know, local chips, Rod Ripple Chip Company, and places like that. And some interesting drinks and things. So people can come in and get lunch. We'll likely have soups and a salad or two a day as well. So.
Now, will you be selling wine and beer, a liquor license, or now or down the road? Or?
So the plan for the site beyond the market is there's a large parking lot outside that has been, you know, the discussion is a little bit ongoing, but part of the discussion is a food truck park. So if that happens, yeah, we're planning to do a small bar with beer and wine service so that the patrons of the food truck park can come to sit on the patio and have a glass of local beer, some wine. And even maybe, you know, get some cheese to go with their meal from us. And then beyond that, if that doesn't happen, we do plan to get a retail license to carry just, you know, a small selection of nice wines and some local beer as well.
That would pair very nicely with the product line you have going.
Yeah, we definitely want to do things like tastings and pairing events. We want to do, you know, kind of informal or small classes where people can come in, you know, as a group or whatever and learn about pairing wine and cheese and even things beyond that that can be paired together. So, yeah, I think that's something that we definitely want people to do.
I think that sounds great. I think that's a wonderful resource for the neighborhood. Now, kind of tell me sort of the timeline. You've been working on this for the good part of the year, right?
Yeah, so we started, I think, you know, it's probably a little bit over a year ago that we really started to get serious about it and kind of went through a couple of sites that were great. We considered being next to Milktooth for a while and the timing didn't work out. So now, you know, we came on this site, we got the money figured out. This site has been a little bit of a back and forth because it is an historic district. So we just wanted to make sure we did things right with that. So, you know, just beyond that, between that and the renovations that had to happen in an old grungy garage, things kind of took longer. But I think that's, you know, that's kind of what people have come to expect, that these projects, if they're done right, they take some time. So.
Now, you mentioned that it's in a former garage. Tell us exactly where it is and what it looked like before.
Yeah. So the location is at 1015 Virginia Avenue, and it's an old garage. It last was used as an auto sales lot where they also did work on cars before they sold them. So, you know, it was covered in grease. There were grease traps that were full of oil that had to be cleaned out. You know, we had a lot, just, you know, really tearing out ceilings and removing almost everything that was in here. We've kept a couple original pieces of metal that were in here that, you know, kind of on display and repurposed those. But, you know, it's an interesting site. The way the building's positioned with the street is kind of fun. So, you know, it's nice. It's a fun repurpose that we're excited about.
We've been talking with Craig Sanders of Wildwood Market. For more information on the new Fountain Square Food Shop, go to wildwoodmarket.com or look for it on Facebook. Indianapolis farmers markets are terrific. Not only do they provide a great place to shop and eat, but they also serve as business incubators, giving food artisans an opportunity to launch a business. Jennifer Cheesem of Pierogi in a Pinch has done just that. Her new pierogi shop in Pendleton offers a variety of the little Phil dumplings. I stopped in recently to check out Jennifer's new shop and to try a few pierogies.
Pierogies are a Polish and Slovak delicacy that I grew up making in my family. And now Here in Pendleton, downtown Pendleton, I open a shop where I can make pierogies, sell them frozen or fresh platters for dine-in or carry-out guests. Even we are doing holiday orders and special orders if anyone needs something other than for a holiday, if they're doing a dinner event or catering event. But I grew up making them, and I'm so glad with over the years doing them at farmers markets since 2009 that I can have my own location and bring it to all to enjoy. So,
well, now tell me a little bit about how you did get started in the farmers markets.
Oh, okay, sure. In 2009 was my first year at the Carmel Farmers Market. I started as a personal chef, and that was what I was trying to do is marketing with my chef business. But I figured, hey, I haven't seen pierogies since I've moved from Cleveland, Ohio, in the Indianapolis region. And it was one of those things where I'm like, I know this. I can make the pierogies, and it's new for people, I'm sure, around the area. And a lot of people have come accustomed to it or was wondering what it was if they ever, if they've never heard about them. But started creating them and just selling them. And ever since then, people have just been asking for more and more, at least when am I going to open my location? But it's been great. Since 2009, I've been on and off doing Carmel and Fisher's Farmers Markets.
Now, what was the reaction at first? I would imagine there were some people who were familiar with them and were happy to find them, but maybe some people weren't.
The reaction all the time was, what is a pierogi? And I was so glad to welcome the whole tradition that I grew up making them, educating people and telling them all about them. All I've heard is that anyone in the Great Lakes region is where people are more familiar with having them. And the ones that were not, I just said, well, that's what I'm here to do. I'm here to have a special product for you, specially made for the area. There are some frozen ones everyone would always tell me about. They go, I think I can find them in the grocery store. But I said, it's really rare, and that's usually the chain brand. But this is an opportunity to make something fresh and local for Indiana to enjoy.
Okay, so tell us exactly what is a pierogi.
Okay, a pierogi is a Polish, and I'm part Slovak, so it's a Polish Slovak dumpling that traditionally you make with fresh dough, and it has custom fillings. Normally the traditional ones are a meat, a potato, or what I grew up having was a prune one, but what I have done, I have made the traditional fillings and now have created my own gourmet, more new style age pierogies for people to kind of have taste that they're familiar with, but also to enjoy. And a pierogi is a boiled dumpling that you saute in butter and onions and serve with sour cream. So, of course, with all of our fillings, maybe the sour cream doesn't go well with, but we're also going to look forward to featuring some sauces that will complement them, too, when we open.
Oh, now tell me first about the different types of fillings that you do have, and your menu probably changes.
Yes,
but.
Yeah, the menu will change. I'm hoping to do a new menu every month, so we're kind of going to feature five different varieties each month, and then we're going to have a dessert pierogi we're going to have each month. Probably just do one of those, but rotate that out as well. Customary, we're going to have the traditional ones on the menu. That would be sauerkraut, a meat one, and a potato. So the people that are always knocking on my door are familiar with those. And there's one that is a very traditional one, is a dry farmer's cheese. And a lot of customers have been asking, if they are familiar, where can they get those? And I will have those in the shop for people to have. But the non-traditional, I'm doing a gourmet twist with, I have a beef and onion, so people that are familiar with having Italian, they kind of go for that. I also do a Polish sausage and sauerkraut. I do a combination. I have many more listed on my website, but for what we have now, for this month, the sharp cheddar potato is a top seller. That will always be on the menu every month, as so many people do enjoy those. And then I did a twist with pepperoni pizza this month, but we will just be rotating them as the months go. I really like featuring the dessert ones, but I also look forward to featuring more of the gourmet and savory ones.
If you could compare them to something, I mean, they do seem a little similar. People might be familiar with, like, the dumplings in Chinese food or other Asian food, but they're not like dumplings like you like in the American South, the chicken and dumplings.
Right.
So I think it's a very interesting contrast.
I think a lot of people like to, what I usually say is, if they're not familiar, that it's like the pot sticker, like you mentioned,
right.
Or in Italian, like the ravioli, and more for Spanish and is more like the empanada, but the empanada is more deep fried. This is certainly a meal that you could deep fry, but it's traditional to just be sauteed and boiled. So, but we try to kind of give people visual comparison because it's what they're used to when they go out to a restaurant or they've seen their grocery store. So they know, oh, okay, I've tried a ravioli, Italian ravioli, that this should be similar. Or I've had an empanada. It might not taste exactly like that because the dough is different, but at least they know what they're going to try to achieve when they're eating their meal with their family. So,
now, what's been the reaction here in Pendleton to a pierogi shop?
It's been overwhelming. We found this great location in downtown Pendleton, and since we kind of took over the shop and decided to, redecorate and do it towards our branding, that, everyone was stopping by. We had our doors open, we were painting, we were meeting the locals. It's gone over fantastic here locally. So we're hoping to spread the word, spread the cheer especially about it. But here locally, it's great. I'm hiring locally. I'm meeting the local people here as well, the business owners here in downtown. So.
Now, did you always have this in mind, when you started thinking about a culinary career?
Probably wasn't exactly this. I knew when I went to the farmers markets myself, when I when I was just looking around, I'm like, I don't see like pierogies, or I don't hear about a Polish shop right around the corner in downtown. I was always trying to find those places when I first moved here, because Cleveland is just saturated with the Slovak village and the Polish places. And my biggest thing was, if there's not something that I grew up eating, I can certainly try to bring it and see if it, people do like it and people do want to taste it. And the answer was yes. So it kind of, for me, was like from one business doing personal chefing where I was cooking for families at home and, where they had their standard standard dishes they're used to having. But I always did the pierogies on the side to kind of to market both businesses, and the pierogi business won. I had to drop off the personal chefing because this is what took off.
We've been talking with Chef Jennifer Cheesem of Pierogi in a Pinch, located in Pendleton. For more information, go to pierogiinapinch.com or look for the business on Facebook. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from the best chocolate in town, purveyors of handmade chocolates and unique desserts, located on Mass Ave. This week on Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio, we are heading back into the kitchen for another Cook This segment, where I challenge local chefs to create a dish using whatever main ingredient I happen to bring. This week, it was skirt steak. Chef Alan Sternberg of Cerulean Restaurant in Indianapolis talks us through how he prepared it.
Probably going to marinate it. If I'm cooking for myself, it's probably going to be some kind of ginger, soy, chili glaze. Or not glaze, but marinade.
Why those flavors?
Because that's what I really like to eat on my days off. A lot of Asian food, a lot of Mexican food, a lot of Latin food on my days off. I kind of restrain from some of it at the restaurant because, cooking at home and cooking at the restaurant are completely different. Inherently different, actually. You don't have a dishwasher. You don't have an endless supply of towels and all the equipment you want and all the herbs you want. So at the restaurant, it's a little more refined. At home, it's a little more just simple comfort food. So I'm going to quickly marinate this in a vacuum. Just for the sake of time, that way you're not here all day. And then I'm probably just going to simply grill it and figure out a couple of accoutrements for it. I'm probably going to grab some gochujang because it's my favorite chili product. It's got a nice little fermented quality to it. I'm going to grab some tamari, some honey, a little bit of rice wine vinegar. Just kind of round out, again, those flavors I really like.
Okay, so now tell me what that does.
All right, so basically, we're just kind of quickly trying to penetrate the meat with a little bit of that marinade, especially the salt, because the salt... molecule is actually small enough it can penetrate meat. Salt and sugar do very well. That's why most brines are comprised mostly of salt and sugar. Also, it's going to make it a little more dense because as it vacuums down, the cells are actually expanding. And then as it lets go of that vacuum, it kind of compresses it all down a little bit. It's not actually compression, but it's reinforcing any air gaps that are in between the cells, basically. So I'm already going inherently Asian, so it's got to not necessarily be Asian, but just thinking about flavor profiles in my head. Thinking about prep we already have, thinking about what I can do quickly for you. Yeah, I've got a couple options I'm starting to lean towards. So we got some great wild field mustard that we got from Annabelle Gardens yesterday that I'm looking at immediately. I like mustard and Asian flavors together a lot. Thinking carrot, thinking some baby turnip maybe. Maybe just a nice little root vegetable and mustard salad over top of it, and you know, leave it simple and easy for you.
Now what are you doing?
Alright, so I'm quickly slicing some pickled carrots. There's some baby red carrots that I got from one of my local farmers, and they're quite tasty. I'm throwing the steak on the grill real quick. Get a couple, a little bit of grill marks, and serve it up. I guess I'm also gonna reheat some sauce too.
So what's that?
Okay, this is a tamari sweet potato and five spice puree. I don't really like sweet potatoes, but a lot of people do. So basically, I added tamari to make it saltier, and the five spice complements it actually pretty well. So it's both something comforting and familiar, but at the same time, a little more depth than your normal normal sweet potato puree. Probably my favorite piece of equipment in the whole restaurant right here.
What's that?
French top. My first cooking job, my saute station that I worked was all French tops. So I kind of fell in love with it right from the get-go, and then when I went to like burners, it took me a minute because they act completely different. I mean, I was used to having, you know, 8 pans on the same space that you have, you know, 4 to 6 pans on a conventional cooktop. But you kind of learn to work it, and because it's got hot spots and you can hold stuff, and some things you can kind of not necessarily ignore, but you can kind of just let be for a little bit, like in the corners. And I love that we have one. It was actually one of the things I was most excited about when I took this job, is the fact that there was a French shop.
Tell me what you're doing.
All right, so I'm cutting a couple orange supremes. I'm going to freeze it real quick with liquid nitrogen and shatter it for my little mustard salad.
So what's that?
This is pickled mustard seeds. Pickled with a little bit of rice wine vinegar, salt, sugar, a couple other things. We use it on... I think we only use it on the pork dish right now. But we like it a lot. It's a nice little pop of acid. It's not overly assertive for mustard or spicy or anything. Nice little texture element on the plate.
Alright, so tell me what you're doing.
I'm finishing this with a little bit of... Malden salt on top of the cup face. Anytime I cut a meat, I like to salt it. Obviously, there's no salt in the middle. I'm going to finish it with a little bit of lemon oil. We cook lemon rinds at 140 degrees for 2 hours, and shockingly bright lemon flavor for an oil. It just comes out beautifully. And then finishing the whole thing with a little bit of red vein sorrel. I got from Josh Horgan yesterday, actually, because it's gorgeous and delicious, and again, a nice little bit of acidity, and the dish is probably more suited for a summer afternoon than a dreary day in December, but hey, you know.
So how do you decide, what are you looking at when you're trying to decide where you're putting the garnish on?
I don't know. So my background, I have a little bit of photojournalism background, so it usually goes into rule of thirds as far as composition. So I really like negative space. I like bright visuals. I like some symmetry throughout it. I like organic shapes, but with a purpose, I guess. That way, every plate I do, I try to have some kind of organic element on the plate to kind of to bring it back to something recognizable. I don't know. I just like clean food, whether that's, I mean, plate, flavors, whatever. So this plate's actually, I think this plate's done.
So describe it now.
Okay, so we have a gochujang marinated skirt steak with pickled mustard seed, five spice sweet potato, pickled carrot, baby turnip, black radish, and a fresh mustard salad.
We've been talking with Chef Alan Sternberg of Cerulean Restaurant. For more information on the restaurant, go to ceruleanrestaurant.com or look for the chef on Facebook. Well, we are all about local food here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, and local food means local bees. And happily, there is a growing interest in beekeeping in Indianapolis. You can check out the beepublic.com website for information, classes, and even a beekeeping kit for holiday gift giving. But to find out how a local beekeeping business gets started, I talked with Kent Allison of Two Bears Honey recently about how the business got going, what happens during a tough winter, and what happens when a swarm of bees finds you.
Well, my partner and I, 2 years ago, or actually more than 2 years ago, he introduced me actually to bees, and I never thought, you know, as much as I do of them now because of all the medicinal properties that they have. I found out that they're actually a little community, and they have such an intricate part of the ecosystem that I didn't even realize, and he had been bringing up bees with his kids for years, and when he moved in here, he wanted his kids to have bees that they could be involved in, and that's where he introduced it to me.
So what'd you think about them at first?
I stayed my distance. I was like most people where I thought, you know, keep away, they're bound to sting you, they'll swarm all over you. And that certainly wasn't the case. What I found was that they're curious creatures. They came out, the first bees that we had, when they didn't know where they exactly were, they had a new home, a new hive. They come out, and then they explore. And the first bees that came up to me, they do these figure eights. They fly in front of you in figure eights, and they do the same thing in front of their hive. And all they're doing there is they're imaging, and they're imprinting who you are, what you are you a threat, are you not, what's my home look like. Just really interesting creatures, and I can't get enough of them now. They're like my family pet.
Oh, that's very interesting. So how did it expand? How did the first year go?
Well, our first year and a half, 2 years, our very first year, we bought our own bees and our hive. And we didn't expect to harvest because they needed to build up their own honey and storage, and which they did. That winter was tough for them, and they actually died in April. That was our first batch, and we thought, well, we'll get some more bees. And in March, that was March. In April, we noticed a couple of scouts that came to the hive, and we thought, well, they're just looking for what's inside there. They'll rob the honey and take it back to wherever they live. And it was an hour later, our backyard was just covered. It was black in bees.
You got a swarm found you?
A swarm found us, and then they turned our hive into their own home. And throughout all the dead bees, cleaned house, they made the hive, which was looking a little unkept, and they made it look like their own home and cleaned it up.
Oh, that's fascinating. How long did that take? You said you looked out and you saw them. What happened next?
It was that morning we saw a couple of scouts, and within an hour or two we had the swarm, and that lasted maybe about an hour, if that, and they had moved in. And over the next couple of days they had cleaned house, moved out all the dead bees, and named that hive their own.
That's wonderful. So, because I know a lot of times, you know, when the bees die, and it's kind of hard, to get them get a new colony established. So that's kind of neat that they just found you.
It was, and the kids were here for that, and they absolutely loved it and seeing how that happened. And they actually produced a lot more honey than the ones that we had purchased. We had purchased Italian bees, and we think what's out there is Russian bees. They're a little hardier. And they produced, out of the one hive that we have with three supers we had on top, 75 pounds in their first year. So the swarm worked out best.
Well, this is like tough bees, tough and high-producing bees. So what did you do then? What happened next?
Well, we realized we had a little colony of little worker bees out there, so we lovingly called them the girls. And the thousands of girls that work for us, they made their nest. They also produce 75 pounds of honey. We invited our neighbors, family, friends. We had a number of people in late August that came over for the uncapping of all the frames and the harvesting of the honey. And it was an afternoon of fun. We videotaped the entire process of how that happens, how it happens, because a lot of people, like I did, are afraid of bees, and they don't know, are they going to sting me, are they going to hurt, I need to keep my distance. And what they found through those videos is they're interesting creatures that have no interest in really what you're doing. As long as you're not harming them, they're there to protect their honey and to thrive off of that. So it was an interesting learning experience for everybody who was involved.
So now, how do you go about getting the honey, with the bees there, if they're going to protect their honey, how do you go about harvesting that?
We use it was a board where you put on a vapor, and that vapor, the bees don't like it. So as we put the board on the top super, it shoved all the bees, or the bees went into the next super, and we were able to harvest the very first super. And then we vacuum the rest of the bees, or we blow out the bees, and then we take it into an obscure location where they can't follow us. And then we repeat the process.
So now that super, that is the levels of the beehive, is that right? Mm-hmm.
The first two are usually about a foot deep, and that is their brood and their own honey. So they got their brood, and then they have their own storage for the winter. And then anything above that, the smaller supers, is what you harvest. When our family and friends knew that we were harvesting our own honey, we sent out on our own personal Facebook pages, and it was spoken for before we even had it out of the frames. So it went very, very well. And after we went through all of that, we had people still asking for honey. And we didn't have any of our own to sell. But they still wanted local honey because they understood the medicinal properties and all the goodness that comes from the properties of honey. And so we looked around and found local beekeepers who produce mass quantities of our own local Indianapolis honey. And we bottle it under our name. In these jars that we produce, they're in Muth jars, is what they're called. It's a very 1800s jar that was produced by a gentleman who wanted to be able to provide his honey with the best looking packaging that he could provide back then. And we're still using that same jar that he produced. We have a 1 pound Muth jar. We have a 1/2 pound and a 1/4 pound. We offer it in clover and also in wildflower. And we are now expanding into facial scrubs as well and other medicinal products. And then on our company Facebook page, which is Two Bears Honey, we offer daily tidbits about bees so people can learn about them. And then we also do a daily recipe that involves local honey.
Now tell me how people can get a hold of the local honey.
The local honey is available either by looking at our Facebook page and going to shop through Facebook, or then go directly to our web page at www.twobearshoney.com.
If someone were going to keep bees, how do they actually get the bees if they're not lucky enough to have a swarm come find them?
Well, you can find local beekeepers who can provide you with your own nucleus of bees and your own hive, because you can't buy the hive in a complete kit, including the bees, which is about $325. But if you want to buy your own bees, you have your own hive, or you want to expand the bees, you can buy them over the internet, Kelly Bees, and they come to United States Parcel Post, and you get a call, says your box is here, and it's buzzing.
We've been talking with Kent Allison, who operates Two Bears Honey with partner Scott Tyler. For information, updates, and recipes, find Two Bears on Facebook or go to twobearshoney.com. Well, when I think of honey in Indianapolis, I can't help but think of the honey wine or mead at New Day Craft. And right now, New Day is preparing to release its popular breakfast magpie mead. So it was time to stop in at the Fountain Square Tasting Room to talk with New Day's Tia Agnew and get the story on the breakfast magpie, which will be available December 20th.
Breakfast magpie is our winter seasonal. It is a black raspberry mead that's been infused with espresso from Bee Coffee Roasters. So it's this really lovely kind of heady black raspberry flavored mead. You get the nose of the coffee up front. You get a nice finish with it, but it almost combines at the finish with the raspberries to almost be like a chocolate kind of tone. So whenever people are like, what the hell is this? I'm like, well, the closest thing I can tell you is it's think of a berry noted chocolate stout. It's not like a beer, but it's as close as I can kind of give somebody a point of reference. It's super popular. So, of course, that's the winter seasonal that people clamor for. Then we do a barrel-aged version of that, which usually has a 12 to 14-month aging process on bourbon barrels. That's called our Imperial Breakfast Magpie. It's 2 degrees higher in ABV, so the classic breakfast magpie is 8% ABV. 4% residual sugar for 4.5. And then the Imperial version, and the coffee steeping process is a little bit longer, so it's a richer coffee flavor, whereas the Imperial, we back off the coffee steeping timeline to allow some of the bourbon barrel aging come through a little bit, and it's a 10% ABV and just a hint drier.
Now, when did you develop Breakfast Magpie, and how did the story develop? Because it seems to have become like a cult classic.
It's talk about shocking. We'll tell you about what happened just recently, but we started making something called Magpie. Which was the non-coffee version. The original version was just simply called Magpie. I'm a former birder, so it's purple, and I'm like, or blue, and Magpie loves blue things, and so that was the fun name I gave to it. That was several years ago. And, you know, people loved it, but we were at that point in time wanting to experiment with adding different flavor profiles to our current varieties, and we kind of sat around and said, well, what would be really good with this rich raspberry character? We're like, I'm thinking espresso. You know, I'm an espresso nut. So we did it, and it's amazing. And so that's how Breakfast Magpie, hence the coffee with the breakfast, came upon the name. And so yeah, it's people just love it, and it's been growing ever since. And we've been selling out of it like crazy. And we started distributing it last year, and that was the first indication. We started bottling it last year in distribution in here. That was the first indication. Holy moly, this stuff goes really fast. We had, you know, maybe I'm guessing my numbers. I think around 150 cases total. We had just a few in house, like 30 or 35, and then we had in the restaurant in distribution. Well, within a week in distribution, it was gone. Within 2 days, it was gone here. We're like, oh well. Okay. And we're like, well, that's pretty cool. And then we released the Imperial, as we always did, just in growlers. Well, this year we decided to change up format and do Imperial just bottled. So sorry, guys. From now on, Imperial's only going to be available in-house by glass and then in bottles to go. I don't even think we'll ever distribute it. And the reason being, as you well know, Jolene, we released it last month on Black Friday, and we thought, oh, this will be fun. You know, maybe it'll take the weekend to sell out. We had 62 cases of it. Yeah, 3 hours it was gone.
See, I think, you know, like I mentioned, I was going to come down and get some, and by the time I was getting around, people were posting that it was already sold out. So now, how did you have lines out the door waiting for you to open? So
How does that happen?
Good question. In fact, when we pulled up, you know, it was like an hour and a half before we were going to open. And so I'm like, oh, there's some people out there. I'm like, oh, some awesome diehards. Oh, I'm so lucky. They're so great. And then I went to go open up and, you know, 5 minutes till. I'm like, I want to take some pictures. I'm thinking there'll be like 10 people out there because our window's not very big out front. I looked, I'm like, holy crap. They were down like to like the other end of the block. And I went, oh. I was like, you guys are awesome. I got up on the bench and took a picture and said, thanks, everybody. Now let's come in. And then it was after that, wait, it was still another hour before that we could get through the entire line. So, people were awesome. I felt bad. It was cold. I'm like, oh, next year I'm going to, like, give everybody a hot chocolate maybe or something, you know. So it was amazing. We were completely floored and humbled by the experience.
Do people say what it is that they find so appealing? I mean, it tastes good. Is there something more? What is it?
You know, that's a really good question. For instance, we took it to FOBAB, the Festival of Barrel Aged Beers, this past year, just to kind of get it out there outside the States to see what people thought. People went crazy. I always am hearing it's like nothing I've ever tasted. And I'm like, wow, that's really exciting. You know, I'm the owner, so I'm like, well, is it the balance of flavors? Is it the uniqueness? Is it the richness? What is it? Everyone just says it's just like nothing I've ever tasted. So they just really, I don't know, they just must be drawn to something super unique, and it's amazing. We love it.
Well, now describe it for me again, just so that I get this, you know, get a good idea of what it is that they've not had before.
Sure. So the classic breakfast magpie, what we're about ready to release on the 20th, it's a black raspberry mead. So imagine black raspberries being co-fermented with honey. It's this rich berry-noted flavor, not overly sweet. People assume it is. It definitely has some sweetness to it because you need to counterbalance the richness of the berries and the acidity. So it's nice. It's got a nice headiness, but not over the top. And then we infuse it with espresso on the finish. It's not in the fermentation process, so it's just a steeping or a flavoring process, not a fermentation process. And so you're getting like, it's almost like this cold brew effect from espresso. So you get a lot of layers. You're gonna smell the coffee, you're gonna drink it, you're gonna get a little bit of the coffee mixed with the berries, you're gonna kind of mids the berry, finishes with this coffee, almost goes into chocolate. And then it has a clean finish. You're not expecting that either. I think people are expecting to be really heavy, like a chocolate stout, and it's really clean. So I think people are just like, what is this? And, you know, there's some people out there that are like, well, I can't get my brain around it, but most people are like, this is awesome.
Now, when you were developing it, what were you thinking about when you were developing it? Just the flavors, or did you have, were you... thought maybe there was some magic happening then.
You know, maybe I'm just dumb, but I'm such a nerd. Everybody who knows me knows I'm a total like science and food nerd. So, you know, it's always about what is this cool cacophony of flavors we can create. Kind of the base underpinnings of New Day, no matter what we make, it's about balance of all the flavor profiles. So no matter what you get from us, if it's a barrel-aged version, it's not just going to be a sock of bourbon in your mouth. I can give you a shot of bourbon, you know, and have a glass of beer with it or a glass of mead with it. But, you know, so when we developed it, we wanted to get the layering. We wanted to get the coffee, and we wanted to layer it with we didn't want it just to be this muddled mess in your mouth, which in some ways you can get, or just a one-note wonder. It was really, truly, we were just super focused on this really cool flavor compilation. We had no idea it was going to be such a cult favorite. And again, I'm still, like, reeling, and I'm still shocked. I'm excited for Saturday, so we'll see what happens on Saturday.
Now, what do you expect on Saturday? Now, this is the release of the Breakfast Magpie.
Yep.
Now, is this available, this is your seasonal,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is only available in the winter months, is that right?
Exactly. And, you know, I never can exactly dictate as far as when it's going to run out, but this is the first year we're releasing it a month early. Normally, we don't release it until January for a myriad of reasons, but we decided, you know, we want to kind of make the holiday season even more festive, so we're releasing it in-house only in December 20th. It'll be glasses, growlers, and bottles. In January, I'm not exactly sure on the date yet. We will post it, everybody. We will be then letting it go in distribution in kegs and in bottles. So our rep, Cavalier, who's great, so when are we getting it? And I've got restaurants and bars asking me, so when is it coming out? I'm getting liquor stores saying, so hey, let me know. And because it is a limited availability. We make more every year, but it seems like, and again, we planned on making a lot more this year, but who knows how long it's going to last. But we're hoping it will last through January into February is our hope. Now, of the kegs in-house, the bottles are probably not going to be around for that long.
So tell me how much the bottles are, and you also have it by the glass, right, and growlers. How much are those?
So in-house here, the bottles, which are 16.9-ounce bottles, they are going to retail for $10, and everything's plus tax. And then the glasses, which are 12-ounce pour, are going to be $7. And then the growler fills, which are 32 are going to be, they're going to be $16 for a fill.
Do you have other things in mind, you know, to try to expand on the Magpie?
Maybe we do, Jolene. Are you a mind reader? We're not quite ready to disclose what that's going to happen next year, but of course we'll have Imperial back. We'll have the Classic back, of course. We'll always be releasing the Imperial on Black Friday. We are in discussions about some other possible formats for that Black Friday release. So
that sounds so much fun. And it sounds like you are having fun with this.
It's a blast. I mean, you know, who else gets to nerd out around like different recipes and formulas? And it's alcohol, so it's way fun. Yeah, we have a great time with it.
We've been hearing about cult classic breakfast Magpie Mead with New Day Crafts' Tia Agnew. For more details on the mead, go to newdaycraft.com or look for it on Facebook. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible through support from Glazers, marketers of fine wines and spirits. Well, it's getting closer and closer to Christmas and New Year's, and that means it's time for celebrating, or maybe just treating yourself to something special. I talked recently with Chef Alan Sternberg of Cerulean about the downtown restaurant's tasting menu, which sounds like a fun and festive holiday indulgence.
So the tasting menu.
Yeah.
What's up with that? Why do a tasting menu, and how does it work?
Why not do a tasting menu? Actually, it was in one incarnation here before I got here. So I kind of inherited it and ran with it, and Pete and I both kind of got really excited about it. Originally, the idea was several courses of dishes that were already on the menu. And then it was kind of a no-brainer. It was, why don't we just do different dishes? So it just kind of evolved over time. At first, it was two or three new dishes, and then it was, you know, well, I'm going to, you know, I got to do a whole new menu. And then Pete really kind of stepped up. Well, not that he didn't ever step down. His food looked a lot better than mine, and so then it was like, I gotta show Pete. And then I don't think I've ever hit that mark yet, but it evolved naturally over time, and it's been a great tool for me in the kitchen to learn and grow and experience new things, experience new product, new cooking technique, stuff I've seen from other chefs around the country as far as technique, where I get to come in and, you know, that was really cool. What if we do this?
So what's on a tasting menu? What will people experience when they try something like that?
Okay, so we do between 9 and 10 courses, depending on the menu. If it's very meat heavy, we usually do 9 courses just because we don't want people feeling disgusting when they leave. And then if it's depending on how vegetable focused it is, we might do 10 courses. Or if we have a really heavy course in spot 3, we'll go ahead and add an extra course right after that, a palate cleanser, really. So with the 9 to 10 courses, you get an amuse-bouche, which is kind of an opening bite, kind of gets your palate going. Then we do 2 savory courses, traditionally an intermezzo, or no, sorry, a fish course, so 3 savory courses. Then an intermezzo as a palate cleanser is what an intermezzo is. And then some kind of protein or beef or duck or some kind of heavier protein main course. Then we do a pre-dessert, a dessert, and a menu D, which is kind of a little thank you, send you on your way, bite from P, just one last kind of gift, if you will. We like it when guests come in and, you know, we get to take them on a little bit of a ride and kind of really show what we're about as chefs.
So that's sort of the idea of it, is to just come in for the experience, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, there's very limited decisions to be made that night. You come in and you kind of put yourself in our hands, and you know, Trish, our maitre d', our head maitre d', she does a great job of reaching out to clients before they come in for a tasting menu, and get input on what they like, and we kind of customize the menu around them, dietary restrictions. We've done all sorts of things. We've done vegetarian. I don't think we've done a vegan yet. That's not a challenge. Don't take it as a challenge. But we've had very specific dietary restrictions, all sorts of allergies. And again, because of the format of the tasting menu, sometimes it's challenging to do, you know, 9-10 courses around the dietary restrictions. Sometimes it's really fun for us because it pushes us so much further. It's, you know, oh, no dairy. Well, I mean, that's a huge part of my repertoire, but when I get away from that, it's, okay, cool, I get to use these ingredients, and, you know, I can't do this, but I can do that, and it just makes me look for alternatives and makes me grow a good bit more.
Is the tasting menu always available? Do you have to, is it a special reservation kind of thing, or how does it work?
The tasting menu is reservation only right now, because it is something special. Originally, it was offered to pretty much people that booked for anniversaries. We've kind of opened it up. You can check out our website. You can call our hosts in and find out more information. It is reservation only right now. There's a hope and a dream to get us to the point where we can facilitate that 6 nights a week to every customer that comes in the door.
How much does a tasting menu typically cost? Is there a range depending on the type of it of menu that you choose?
No, right now it's $85, which for 9 to 10 courses you're paying less than $10 a course. It's kind of to me it would be a no-brainer, but some people that can afford it and people that want to do it, it's the best representation of our restaurant. I think that's the real key part. Is we wanted to price it where it wasn't scary to people that really wanted to enjoy the restaurant. But at the same time, again, you know, if people don't want to do that, come on in. You know what? We're here to make you happy, and that's really what the restaurant's about. And some people want a little bit more of a grand experience. Some people don't. And that's why it's just kind of an option. And, you know, you want to celebrate something or you want to do something special for a significant other or because you got a promotion or whatever. It's a great way to celebrate, and it's a great way to enjoy the evening and, you know, have great conversation and sharing in wine and food and communion, all those things that we try to promote here at Cerulean.
We've been talking tasting menus with Cerulean Executive Chef Alan Sternberg. For more details, check out ceruleanrestaurant.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. I'd like to thank our guests this week, Craig Sanders of Wildwood Market, Chef Alan Sternberg of Cerulean Restaurant, Chef Jennifer Cheesem of Pierogi in a Pinch, beekeeper Kent Allison of Two Bears Honey, and mead maker Tia Agnew of New Day Craft. And thanks to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.